Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
How are you?
I am a good.
Hey, folks, is this Rick having a triumph?
Rocking and rolling, ladies and gentlemen, Brother Shane and I, we started this show in a car. Now we're in two cars.
Two cars.
Rockers on the move, Shane in Delaware, checking out some records, and I'm sipping some coffee and might go look for some vinyl. Boy, look myself outside of Detroit. What's going on, my brother?
Well, you have third man there, so I would already be in there right now.
Yes.
Because Jackpot's out exclusive stuff, man, every week.
Oh man,
We're
take
live.
two. And we're live. That's right. This is what happens when Shannon and I have to talk for a while. We just lose it. Just like the old days. Rick Emmett on the show, the Triumph legend, and talking about what's that collection, my brother?
It's diamonds. Diamond Dave, no, as in Diamond Dave. No, Rick has released Diamonds, the best of the hard rock years, 1990 to 1995. It's a
Yeah.
compilation featuring Rick's handpicked rock tracks from his three Duke Street releases, Absolutely Ipso Facto and The Spiral Notebook, and plus he put on two previously unheard songs. So
Yeah,
it
which is
sounds
really
like
cool.
So I guess Rick Emmett fans are going nuts because there's two new songs and all this stuff was remastered, which and I know that the remastering nowadays is just on point. And it's being released through Music in Motion Entertainment in Canada and Decca Entertainment in the US and the world. So there's only 400 sets of this available, and it's on sale through Rick's web store through rockpapermerch.com. And then I see Chipster in there, they're like rascal.
Yeah, it's the good old Chipster. What's so cool about it is this collection, he talked about how it was just like falling in love with it again, discovering these tracks again and just really going back in time,
Yeah. So he tells all kinds of stories on the deluxe edition of his Triumph and solo years. He did a video stream back in January where he talked about a lot of that stuff, and all purchasers of the deluxe edition will receive a private link to that stream, exclusive stream. And there's some of the editions are hand signed randomly, so they mix that into it as well. So that goes really cool because they're doing like very limited pressings of a lot of this stuff. We're talking 200 editions of 200, 300, 400, which makes it that much, more rare and collectible, which I kind of like. Like you can't sleep on this stuff because it's like, oof, it'll be gone. Like the trapeze thing that they did with, for Medusa and the other album for Glenn. I mean, those were sold out in like very short period of time.
What is it like? We're talking as you were just kind of doing some collecting, hitting the streets and finding some classic vinyl. I mean, what does that mean for you as a collector? To whenever you get your hands on something that's a part of a rare limited edition release, how cool is
It's an adrenaline rush, man. It's
that?
I've come across signed stuff before. And you can tell, you can tell, dude, when a lot of times it'll have promotional, one sheets in it, it'll have the press photo in there. So you know that it's legit. You don't really have to go and get it approved or certified because all you got to do is look online and boom. I picked up CDs from Elton John did an event once in California, and the sponsor of the event had like cards that went into the CD and Elton's signatures on them. I have actually, it was a CD I just got today. It's kind of like, I don't know what it is, but it's from the Delphonics.
Oh
Remember
yeah.
from Philly? And the
Oh
whole
yeah,
thing's
man.
signed. Yeah, the whole
That's
thing's
awesome.
signed.
Look at
See
that.
that?
Oh, that's
Everybody.
awesome, man.
And the
Yeah.
inside sign, like the inside part of it.
Look at that.
So it says, stay close to God, the Delphonics. La 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 la.
Oh,
Much love. Like the three guys that are still alive signed it. I guess I forget how many Delphonics there were, Dave. Do you remember?
I don't
Four?
remember. I think there were a
It's
few, four,
usually
and
four,
then,
right?
yeah, usually. I think so. Yeah.
So I just I know there's probably somebody out there who really wants something like that. So I hang on to it until I can't hang on to it anymore.
Yeah.
But
Good stuff, man. Yeah.
Rick, we got to talk to him a couple years ago, and we got to he was doing a sort of a it wasn't rock, it was a more acoustic
Like a
progressive type.
classical, yeah.
Beautiful stuff. And we were talking to him about everything from baseball to to the upcoming Triumph documentary. That and did you get to talk to him much about the documentary that
Little
went
bit,
through?
yeah. In fact, yeah, a little bit. In fact, and I'm going from memory from the interview. I think this collection was supposed to come out around the same time as that. Actually, you know what? I think it was around the same time as his book, something around there. But yeah, he talked about how that. The sense I got from the interview was that documentary really got the ball rolling for a lot of things down the road. You know, a lot of some of these projects looking back. At least that's what it felt like. You know.
Yeah. And just a sweetheart of a guy. Made some of the most incredible guitar based, albums. And they were like a trio from Canada that kind of came in the same sentence as another trio from Canada. A lot, when people would talk about Triumph, they talk about Rush. When people would talk about Rush, they talk about Triumph. But as Rick would tell you himself, they kind of lost their way. The in industry kind of snuck up on them, and they slowly started to, I don't want to use the term sell out, but they tried to accommodate a sound that they really weren't. And they were making videos, and they hated them. And everything in the business was changing because MTV, and they were not. That wasn't their thing, and I think one of the funniest parts of the documentary was when Rick almost got kicked in the face by a dancer, and they showed it in the documentary, and she almost took off his nose. And it's just like, what are we doing? And then they just kind of pulled the plug. Gil, Mike, and Rick called it a day. And decided to go their separate ways. And what was really neat about the documentary was that they had a thing for super fans in there at the end. They did a concert for super fans, and it's pretty much the only thing they've done since they broke up. And it was like, yeah, I was blown away by the documentary, and we got to talk to Mike Levine about that. So
Yeah,
we've had a,
he's a character too.
and it's just a lot of fun. These guys, they're just so laid back, down to earth people.
They're wonderful, yeah.
And Rick has written some of the most, and we've talked about this before on the show. Rick has written some of the most incredible songs, word wise. He writes about, beating the odds and standing up for yourself and confronting, obstructions and stuff in your life and not giving up. And a lot of Triumph songs have become anthems for people who are down and out. And Mike talked about that a bit, and Rick did, where people like wrote him and said, "Hey man, thanks for writing, fight the good fight," or I can't think of the other song, but just about how much
The magic power
magic
was the
power and
magic
just how those songs changed my life and made me get back on track. Thank you.
Absolutely.
And that was the kind of amazing power that Triumph had. Still love them, man. They're a great
Yeah.
band. I wish they were still around. I know I get why they're not, but it's kind of like the Police, you know. Would it be the same if the Police were still together? Probably not.
Yeah.
It's too
Yeah, I
much
think
water's under the bridge, you know.
yeah, I think so. That and just, Sting kind of moving so far ahead in his career and doing his thing. And Andy, he was talking with Rick Beato not long ago, I think, and Andy's such one of those. Andy, to me, is kind of like Rick in a way. I mean, a virtuoso, or certainly of that classicist kind of league, you think, maybe? Is that fair to say? And just always creating, Lou John Roth too, always going. Just living in the now, and it's always an interesting thing for us, like as fans, because we go back to an era and we go back. There's eras. There's a song or something, but the artists, they just keep moving. They just keep moving ahead. And I get that, but then I sometimes forget that I forget to get that because, as a fan, we get so stuck in this thing they did or this thing, and it's just such a unique perspective,
They're Still Moving as a great
Yeah.
band.
Yeah, yeah.
And the documentary Rock and Roll Machine came out in 2021. It was free on Prime, I think. That's where I saw it.
Yeah.
Or I think the band sent us the link, and
Yeah,
that's
they
how I
yeah, we
saw it.
saw an advanced copy, yeah, which is really cool.
And if you haven't seen the documentary, it's still very popular. That I mean, it kind of gives you an idea of how many people like Triumph. The documentary is still one of the most popular documentaries out there,
Yeah.
especially for music. And it was just such a neat story, and the way they told it, and the interviews from the guys kind of gave you hope that maybe there was a possibility that they would get back together, but
Yeah.
alas.
It was great how they followed a lot of super fans. There were a few super fans that were kind of integral into the story, which was great. Because, like, who can't relate to that,
And then they had like
Yeah.
John Five in there and Sebastian Bach and some other
Yeah.
people talking about. But Triumph wasn't the only band, you know, and it always makes me wonder. I guess it's better to go out like that than it is to fade. And I
Yeah.
think maybe that's why Rick and those guys decided to just pull the plug and keep it the way it is, because maybe it's just better to go fade off than to just, burn out and make crappy records and stuff like that. You know, they went out at the height of their popularity, basically,
Yeah.
or shortly after. And the Police did as well. I mean, Synchronicity was one of the biggest albums of all
Oh.
time.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it really
So.
was. And yeah, there's like Betty beat that and then just a great launching platform for Sting, the solo works and yeah. Yep, and then Stewart would do orchestral arrangements and soundtracks, I think, and yeah. But yeah, it's almost like how do you top something like that? I mean, that
But
battled Thriller for the top spot.
Triumph didn't really have to endure the grunge thing like a lot of bands did. And, maybe that's why Rick was making these records at that time. The records, the songs that are on Diamonds. And grunge pretty much destroyed everything. Rock based for the most part. I mean, it just took over.
Yes.
There wasn't a lot coming from the Paul Simons and stuff like that. All that stuff was just kind of like, get it out of here.
Right.
You
Exactly.
did have Jimmy Page and Robert Plant together, though. That was an exciting time.
That was cool.
They were back together, and you did have shortly before that, you had Page and Coverdale doing their thing. And
It's two amazing projects. Oh my God.
again, we'd still like to see the Coverdale Page thing get a wider release. It just got released on an import. Our friend Randy Smith picked it up, but I think it
Yes.
cost him like 60 bucks. And I'm like, I'm not doing that.
Right.
I have it on CD. I'm good. But
Right.
anybody has it out there, has it on vinyl, and they want to get rid of it at a reasonable price, I'll take you up on it. But I'll
Yeah.
wait. Because that's one of those that it sounded to me like they're going to probably do some remastering and finding other tracks and stuff that they didn't release.
Yeah.
But what was your what did Rick kind of leave you with? How did you I wasn't in on this interview this one because of my scheduling, unfortunately, and my other job. But what did Rick kind of what do you feel like he was getting across to you through
I
the
think
course of the
just
interview?
just how grateful he was to be able to look back and just the excitement again, revisiting, I think it's almost like maybe on a smaller scale for you and I, when we look back at a story we did in the news business years ago, we're like, oh wow, forget about that. I really felt good about this or felt good about that. Like anybody can relate to looking back on something that was a really positive thing in their life, and that I just the way he lit up about that and how he said he wanted to go from that to like another project, kind of remastered best of project, dealing with more of, I want to say he was saying not so much love songs, but more of the softer kind of stuff that he had done, maybe a little bit more of the acoustic type of work, just revisiting some of those projects. I think that, that's what struck me, is just the gratitude he had looking back, especially for something that wasn't Triumph, as proud as he is, obviously, of that, elevating some of those solo works that maybe people might have missed, especially during that time, 1990 to 1995, when, like you said, everything changed, and rock just wasn't, it was all grunge, But that was my
Did he,
impression.
do you feel like he, did you get to talk to him much about the band? Is he still friendly with Mike and Gil? Is he, have they met up? Anything like that?
Yeah, he talked a little bit about that. And I'm going from memory here because the interview was a little bit ago, so I'm trying like a interview was a little bit ago, a few weeks ago. But I feel like he, there's conversations between them, but sounded like there wasn't really anything hardcore in place in terms of like ever doing anything again. There's communication, but everybody's kind of in their own space. Is really what it
There's
seemed like, what
no,
I recall. Yeah.
yeah, there's no one person trying to keep it from
Yeah.
happening or anything like that. You didn't get that
Yeah. No,
impression.
that's not the impression I got now.
They're
Yeah.
just
Which is,
friendly and they
yeah.
accomplish so much together that they're always going to be friends and
Yeah. He said something
leave
about
it
how
at
they,
that.
yeah. He said something about how they did. There was a semi-recent get together, but I think it was more, it wasn't like about doing anything big and broad. It was more like just a social kind of thing,
Well, that's cool.
Yeah. I wonder, I'm recalling, I recall it's,
Yeah.
it's funny. I haven't listened to the interview since, like, it did it a
Well,
little while ago, a few weeks ago. And it's like, trying to remember yesterday is like, what happened yesterday?
yeah, I couldn't tell you what happened yesterday. I don't even know what I do from day to day anymore. So I'm putting you on the spot. So Dave, prove it now. what's he using now? Like what guitars is he kind of
He was in a really cool studio that I think actually he did the interview in for the parts that he did for the documentary Rock and Roll Machine. Because I remember seeing he's got a lot of acoustics on the wall.
yeah.
He says he grabbed there's a Telecaster that he's been playing a lot to get that Tele sound. I do remember that. And
Right.
there's some acoustics that he grabs. He said whatever just kind of grabs him at the moment. I remember he was talking a lot about Les Pauls in the first interview we did, how the chambered Les Pauls don't like there's the they don't have as much of a punch, but then he would go to the other ones and there was like a real punch and edge to them. But he seems to be really into grabbing the tele,
Is he using six strings? Is he using eight?
yes. Six, I believe. Yeah.
He doesn't break out the double neck.
And not that I've seen. I mean, I didn't see that in the studio, But it might have been in the back there. Yeah, I think he said he's got about 40. I think about 40 guitars in there, I want to say, something like
Wow.
that. Yeah, which is just any guitar player's dream. Oh my God, I got what, four in my bedroom, and I'm like, oh, you always want more.
Yeah, I always wish the best for those guys because they were part of the US Festival. They were part of a big time in our young lives, and
Yeah.
I mean they were as big as anybody back then. And sad not to have them around, but we're kind
Yeah.
of getting used to bands not being around at this point. Unfortunately, it's becoming a thing.
Yep. What
You know.
that US Festival show is so iconic. I mean, what when that hit, was it MTV? I mean, will you remember that? I mean, tell me about like when that first hit and how big it was.
I don't even remember. I don't remember who
Oh,
had it
okay.
on. Because we didn't have MTV, but we had it on. I don't know if NBC, ABC, or CBS put it on, but it was a Saturday and a Sunday, and I know the radio stations carried it. And you kind of just had to visualize in your mind what was going on because I probably recorded about 3 or 4 hours of it, if I can remember. I recorded Judas Priest, Motley Crue, Triumph. But the lineup was set up so you had like metal one day on the main stage. There wasn't like a three stage thing, it was all just one stage. So you had metal one day, you had hard rock another day, and you had new wave in there on the third day. And everyone from Van Halen to The Clash to you name it. Even bands like Missing Persons and Oingo Boingo, stuff
Wow.
like that played. And it was all Steve Wozniak from Apple. That was his doing.
Yeah,
He
that's
wanted to
insane, right?
celebrate music and he footed the bill for it with the money that he was making as a computer engineer and basically founding Apple with Steve Jobs. And he wanted to have a festival, so that's what they did. And I don't know what Triumph ended up making off of it. Like, I'm sure they paid the bands handsomely because they had all the big names at that festival.
Right.
Everybody that was anybody pretty much played it.
Oh yeah. Like that was like any yeah, that was like the thing.
Yeah.
83, right? 83.
Quiet Riot. I mean,
Yeah.
all those bands that were just getting big at that time
Yeah.
and ended up playing the festival. So it was like every one of us in our Pennsylvania neighborhood wanted to go to California that summer to see it, but the lucky people that lived out there got to see it, pretty much the Californians.
Yeah.
And Triumph was at that state point in their career where they were as big as anybody.
Yeah.
And they played an electrifying set, man. Amazing set.
Yeah. Yeah,
I
man.
would like to see that whole concert get officially assembled and released,
Oh
you
my
know.
God, yeah.
But I mean, heck, most of the people who were there aren't even here anymore, so
I know, sadly, I know.
it kind of feels like I don't know if it was tied up in rights or what, but it was televised somewhere. I can't remember where, but it looked amazing. I mean, they had like Steve did it upright and it was shot perfect. The sound was perfect. Vince Neil actually sang words. But I remember Triumph being very impressive in their set, and we played the crap out of that stuff, dude.
I bet, man.
I
Was
still have
it?
them some.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, I wish that a lot of that stuff was like even just put on CD version or just up, but even just to drive to it and play it. And I love driving to like live albums, you know, it's just there's an energy there. You know, you go on a drive somewhere and like I was listening to Hell Freezes Over by Eagles. It's 30 years old now. You know, it's half studio records and studio songs, half live. And there's
Yeah.
just something about that energy, you know. And I don't know. I just think that'd be so cool if they're, yeah, you're right. It's probably tied up in rights, but how great would that be to, you know, get a touch up and release, you know, a DVD and, you know, video and a CD, you know.
Yeah. It was May 29th, 1983. It was billed as Heavy Metal Sunday. And it included Ozzy Osbourne, Judas Priest, The Scorpions, Motley Crue, Quiet Riot, and Van Halen headline.
Wow.
Triumph was also on Heavy Metal Sunday as well. So, but the festival went from May 28th to May 30th. And apparently their performance, if you want to see it, 57-minute performance is up on YouTube, and it looks really good as I'm looking
Okay.
right now. There was a DVD released back in the day. They estimated about 500,000 people strong on Sunday alone. People like Ronnie James Dio were there, and there were two videos. Triumph officially did release something on DVD called Live at the US Festival. It was released about 21 years ago, their version of it. And they did a little documentary and behind the scenes around, which I've never seen, but it's on YouTube if you want to see the
Yeah.
performance part.
Check that out for sure.
And
Hell yeah.
Gil, yeah. And I guess they updated it, put it in DTS surround sound. And Gil Moore and Mike Levine reminisce about the performance in a 15-minute interview from 2003, and that's what the cover looks like.
Love
Shot from the
it.
stage. Who
Awesome.
knew?
I
I
know.
learned
Very
something every day
cool.
when we do this stuff, dude.
I know, man. That's
This
what,
sh
yeah.
show costs me a lot of money. It makes sense because a lot of other bands didn't feel their set was that enthralling. Not Triumph, but their own set wasn't that good, so they never released their stuff. But as far as I know, Van Halen's set still has not been released, which is a crime.
Oh, I know. Dave was in prime form.
Because he, oh, you just had him. I just posted Romeo Delight yesterday from US Festival, and right in the middle of the song, Dave's like, "I forgot the fucking words."
Was he drinking
But the
whiskey or
song,
something?
but the song goes along like as planned, and Eddie doesn't miss a beat. And the Scorpions were too. They were on fire then. Scorpions and Triumph, I would say. I mean, all those bands were just starting to peak. They're starting to get big at the same time. Priest and Ozzy being an exception, and Van Halen because they were already big. But that was a special time, dude.
Yeah, it
It
really
really
was.
was.
Oh my God. So cool.
Here's their set list. Too Much Thinking, Allied Forces, Lay It on the Line, Never Surrender. That's right. That album just came out that year.
That's right. Yeah.
Magic Power, The World of Fantasy, 10 and a half minute version of Rock and Roll Machine. Rock and Roll Machine. When the Lights Go Down and Fight the Good Fight, which that song, like an 8 minute version of it where Rick just destroys, man, shreds. And yeah, what a great time, dude.
Yeah, man. Yeah, and what a great, like, that's the ultimate closer tune, you know?
Yeah.
Fight the good fight. Oh my God.
So I guess I gotta go look for that. I'm here, I'm
Yeah.
talking about it. Yeah, they never released it. That's what I do. That's what I
That's
do,
right.
man.
Yes, and you do it, no one does it better.
I will it into existence. Don't mind stupidity. Is Rick working on new material? Is he going to go back towards rock? Is he going to go back towards classical? Did he give you kind of any idea of what direction he's going in?
Well, I know the One Direction he's looking at is kind of continuing this sort of series of catalog kind of updates, upgrades, facelifts, that sort of thing with some of the more classical or acoustic style guitar. I think that's going to be the next one of the next things. But yeah, he's always creating. He's always in the studio tinkering and creating. So yeah, we'll see. I do think there will be something coming. So I think that'll be pretty cool.
Well, especially if he's getting a facelift. I mean,
Yeah,
sounds like
I know.
just
What
kidding,
David? No, I know. Yeah, as Coverdale was talking about. Yeah, well, it's sort of updating the House of Whitesnake when he was remixing an album.
they've done a heck of a job with their
Yeah.
catalog.
Oh my God, so good.
I
They've
mean,
done great.
I think that's kind of what every fan of every band would like to see is kind of what Whitesnake's done over the
Right.
last 10 years with the catalog, from the Deep Purple stuff to the red, blue, and white comps to, I
Yeah.
mean, that's how you do it.
That's what
I
people
really,
want. Totally.
if people want to have, they want to try to get their hands on as much stuff as they can listen to while they're still around.
Yeah, absolutely,
And yeah, do you like a bunch of those, don't you? What would you say would was your favorite Whitesnake reissue out of the batch?
man. Well, I loved the because he was doing it like there's the love songs, like he was doing the albums, and then like I do like the one Still Good to Be Bad. I like that one because Where the Wind Blows is still Can You Hear the Wind Blow, rather, is still just a great guitar, crunchy Doug Aldrich, Aldrich just punching out those guitars, but I like the there's the hard he's a, there's the hard rock album. There's the hard rock songs that they remix. I like those,
Yeah.
Loving a Stranger, Still of the Night, because there's just they doubled the guitars in some of that stuff, and it just sounds, I mean, just brings it into a whole new, because I guess as audio playing gets better, and speaker systems and such, they want it to
Yeah.
be able to play through that, and that's my favorite. What about you?
Well, I have not listened to all of them. I figured you probably did, but I know that I
Yeah.
thought it was a really cool concept to
Yeah.
do it. I'm kind of like a purist. I like the originals, so I don't like to. But I think for the ultimate fan to have remix tracks with doubled up guitars, layered effects, stuff like that, making it that much harder,
Yeah.
and taking it into another, like you said, another level, taking things to another level, is a really cool idea.
Yeah.
I mean, the stuff sells, so
Yeah.
they're on to
Yeah,
something.
and Coverdale was big about like kind of putting them side by side, kind of having the originals and then doing these remixes too, at least on Good to Be Bad. It's still Good to Be Bad, I think he did that, which is pretty cool,
Yeah. Then did
Yeah.
you hear the Deep Purple offering? The purple
No, not
one?
yet. Not yet.
Yeah.
I've been meaning to play that for a while, and I think I've heard cuts of it, like Burn, but I haven't heard like the whole thing. So that's something I really want to dig into as well. There's so much to listen to, which is a
Dude, that's
great,
the problem.
thing. It's a great problem.
It's a great problem to have, but
Yeah.
honestly, Jay Sonica and I were just talking about this the other day. I was like, it's almost getting to the point where it's too much, like,
Yeah.
you can't keep up.
Right. It's hard. Yeah.
And then when like, do you still appreciate the music if you're constantly jumping from thing to listen to?
Yeah.
And the thing is, there's a ton of stuff from these bands, especially Whitesnake, the older stuff, it's not even available anymore.
Yeah.
And some of that stuff is just unbelievably beautiful and well
Yep.
done.
Yeah, and I think you said there was something that they just got the tapes. Coverdale said they just found the tapes when we talked to him last for a project. I can't remember what that project was, but it's
Well, you
somewhere. It's
said
on the net.
Coverdale
Yeah.
Page.
That's right. Yeah. Yep. Oh my God.
But
We need that. I mean, that's just gonna
Jimmy
be.
was remixing the tapes, and that's why, because it was kind of like, I was trying to tie it into the Triumph thing, but it was like,
Yeah.
out of some of the things that you'd all like to really see get reissued, that would be one of them.
Absolutely, yeah.
But Triumph did a wonderful job getting their albums reissued over the last couple of years. Really quality, really nice quality pressings on marbled vinyl, all different colors. Really well done. Nice deluxe editions of those on vinyl. It would also be nice to see their stuff come back in print with concerts attached to the original album material and stuff like that. Like
That'd be so cool.
UFO has been doing, like, Chrysalis has been doing an amazing job, EMI
Oh my
and
God.
UMG with the UFO catalog. It would be nice to see that happen with Triumph too. I'm sure that
Is that Phil kind of, is it the UFO stuff? Would that be Phil and Shanker doing all that? Because who's left? I mean, there's not many guys left, right, from UFO.
no, that
Sadly,
everyone's
Pete Way's, yeah,
yeah.
I mean, it's just
Most of the band is dead at this point. Michael
Phil
and
or
Phil Mogg are the only people that are really around, and I think that I'm aware of. Pardon my ignorance on this, but no, they just released. They finally released Lights Out, which I know that you like. Lights Out at London. But they that just got a reissue.
I was playing that
Just got a reissue like in the last 3 months.
last night.
Really quality double vinyl with an extra concert tacked in there. And UFO's been doing the management, the band has been doing a phenomenal job of getting those archival materials out because people are eating them up. And I know Triumph fans would do the same. I kind of put UFO and Triumph in a similar category because it was kind of like, it's hard rock. They're hard rock bordering on metal, and I'm just a big fan of that sound. That was a great sound. It's kind of what
Oh
Van
my God.
Halen was like.
Yeah,
And
just
the
those big
songs are there, man. The
guitars and
songs are always there,
That's the thing. You can't just have big guitars. You got to have the songs. You got to have the structures and all of that. But yeah, it was all in place. Oh yeah. Love it.
It's pre-hair metal, just good rock and roll. And it stands the test of time. You can
It
put a
sure
Triumph
does.
record on any day of the week from that era. I'd say never surrender back to rock and roll machine and just be taken away because
My
it's great
favorite
from
thing, oh sorry, I'm
no
sorry.
it's great from top to bottom.
Sorry, these damn delays. Or maybe I just think I think sometimes my mind, I my what comes out of my mouth is what's in my brain at the same time. I'm sorry, I don't know. Too much
No
coffee. It's
speech.
I just did drink this large Dunkin' iced coffee, and I'm like,
Speak, Brother David.
When like John Roberts, he's a White House correspondent for Fox News Channel, and it's funny because he's like on air as a straight laced like rock like a straight laced like news guy, covering I think the White House, and he was with CBS for years. I've always liked his reporting, and his anchoring at CBS, but he's a big Rush and Triumph fan, and he's on I think it's the album Surveillance or Under Surveillance. There's a spoken track where he, this is going back to the 80s,
That's
where
right.
he's on a Triumph album. And I'm just like, this is so freaking cool, man. And he's a guitarist too. Like he jams with his son, I want to say. There's some videos, so it's like, I mean, he loves it too. And I believe he's Canadian as well. So like between, I mean, he's just a massive fan, and it's fun whenever he talks rock and roll on social media, and Triumph.
Yeah, that I would like to. I would like to see their archives get like the ultimate treatment. I know that they've done a really good job with their stuff already, but I always strive for like it's got to be something in the can that never got released or
Something, right?
just a jam, 10-minute jam in the studio. Because
Oh my God.
Rick was truly is one of the greatest of his time. And I only say this because we this is an interview coming up, but Uli John Roth was fortunate enough to talk to him this week. And if you listen to his tracks on Tokyo Tapes, or you listen to his solos on those vintage Scorpions albums, or on his Electric Sun stuff, dude, they're going places that not many guitarists can go. Some of the stuff that he's doing, and Rick was the same way. He was doing stuff that people marveled, you know.
Even
Eddie was a fan, you know. So it was just a great time for that style of guitar playing, and I will still go back and stand by my, I still think it was the best time in the world for fans and guitarists.
I know, I'm with you.
The early 80s, because everybody was still alive, and everybody that was playing, they drove each other. Everyone was driving each other and pushing, you know, they not directly but indirectly pushing each other to get better and come up with something just truly unique. And from Randy Rhoads, Ted Nugent, to Rick Emmett, to Eddie Van Halen, to Alec Lifeson, to you name it, they were all doing it at the same time.
Just everybody was at the peak. I mean, that was the US Festival 2 kind of the, and I guess last thing I had to add, because I know we got to get the listeners are like, where's the interview? But I love this shit. We love this, man. I love this part of the show, just us riffing, you know, no pun intended. But was the US Festival like the first big hard rock? Was that before Monsters of Rock? Was that
in the UK they were having festivals like Glastonbury and Donington and stuff like that. There were some big metal shows back in the day, but over here in the US there wasn't that kind of scene, and that's what I think Steve was trying to create with that, was, hey man, come on, if they can do it overseas, Germany's doing it, and UK's doing it, and European countries are doing it, why can't we? And so that's why he did what he did. And I think having the 3-day thing with three different types of genres really paid off. It was really cool.
And I think
technically, I have to say that I think Triumph set was fucking, pardon my French, but it was so, I remember it being very focused and extremely tight. And it could have been possibly one of their tightest performances they did live.
Yeah.
Arguably. I don't know. But you could just see how focused they were and the drive of all their, they were firing on all cylinders. And as that set list proves, you know, I just kind of felt like they were on fire.
Hell yeah.
Because, I mean, you have to perform when you're on stage with the other bands that were playing that day.
Right.
And that's kind of the thing. That's what makes festivals so cool, is that you don't just go up and mail it in.
Nowadays, you got it.
Maybe now you do, but back then, no, your whole career depended on what you did. And if you went up on stage and blew it, you were done. There weren't tapes and stuff like that back then. I mean, they had to play,
and it was televised live.
Live.
There's no editing. There's no going back and fixing stuff.
So you had to bring it, and that's what I think I miss that the most, is just that. I'm not saying it's not there. It sure is, but that was a magical time for music fans, and I will always go back to that music. Always, Dave.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
I think Rick will too. I mean, despite Rick doing all this other stuff, I think that was his he knows how successful they were. He's not gonna deny the success of Triumph. Triumph was a very successful band, and
huge. Yeah.
And to try to ignore that, you know, it's foolish.
Yeah.
So
absolutely, man. What do you say we jump into this bad boy right here? Rick Emmett's live.
The one and only Rick Emmett.
Woo! Diamonds, Best of the Hard Rock Years, 1990, 1995. Ooh, yeah.
Roll the
This is awesome. Rick Emmett, Diamonds, the very best of the Hard Rock Years is the latest project here. And what a trip down. I mean, Bang On, Drive Time. It's a really cool, just a really nice trip down memory lane here. And it's interesting to kind of go back to some of the hard rock stuff that you've done, because you've had, I mean, obviously we know you for that, from Triumphant, but you've had a lot of classical work that you've done, a lot of different types of guitar. What was it like to kind of go back to this project and all of these great songs here?
Well, first of all, I was grateful for the fact that they were getting a second life. I got the masters back from the three indie records I'd made for Duke Street Records in Canada between 1989, 1990, and 1995, 96. So those three albums, absolutely, Ipso Facto and Spiral Notebook. And so I'm sitting around and going, what am I going to do with these? And then this guy, Greg Campbell, that runs Music in Motion, which he made a deal with Decca. And it was like, hey, we want to put out a compilation. And so it was kind of fun. I hadn't listened to that stuff in, decades,
Yeah.
but it was a lot of fun to kind of be chewing back to it. And, Greg, he's kind of like he's a big music fan. So he's going, okay, what about this song? What about this song? What about this running order? Like he had a lot of fairly strong ideas about how he wanted to maybe try and do it. So it was good. It was like I had a collaborator that, wasn't just like a record company guy that didn't really know what you were about. This guy kind of had a sense of the tunes. And I sort of said, well, how about we lean more towards the hard rock stuff? Because there's plenty of soft stuff too that I'm thinking I might do on another compilation at another point. So that was kind of good because it gave the thing a focus, that it was the harder rock and electric guitar kinds of things, big vocals, that I mean, he goes, I want the ballad. I want When a Heart Breaks. I go, well, I don't know if it fits a ballad. I don't know, we should have really, but and then I go, I said, how about the Pendulum from the Spiral Notebook album? And he's going, he didn't, he wasn't as familiar with that. I go, but look, this will fit in with the vibes of what's going on here. It's like the lyric is a good lyric. It fits with the stuff. It's kind of a, yes, it's a little bit more about recording colors than it is pounding guitars. But as you mentioned, I mean, Bang On is on there. And I go, oh yeah, Big Lie. That Absolutely album, those songs like Drive Time and Stand and Deliver and Middle Ground. There were so many songs that were big, anthemic, prog rockish, a little bit of Queen here, a little bit of Zeppelin there. They were big records, and I was trying to make a statement like, I left Triumph, but I've still got big big ego and big ambition. And so those tracks had that. And then the label that it came out on in the States, they went bankrupt. Charisma literally. So they've serviced a couple of tracks, Saved by Love, Big Lie to FMAOR Radio. And then all of a sudden I woke up one day and it was over.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Like
So it
a
was that record. It didn't really get its due. So, here I am, I don't know what, 4 decades later. Hey, hopefully it's gonna get its due now.
Is that one of the great things about music that you can look back, especially with such a diverse catalog that you have, that you can look back and give kind of a second life to a certain category of songs? And what was it like going back? And I mean, did it take you back to those years? I mean, it's got to be a time machine in a way.
Oh, for sure, yes. And music has that, capability all the time. But the interesting thing too is that, the idea of you write a song, you make a record, you put it out. It sometimes you go, you start playing it live. All of these processes, they you think as the artist that, oh, I know this song. And then when you revisit it after being in the, the getting into the time machine, you go, oh man, I didn't really realize the song kind of had this shade, and time sort of plays on songs to give them you know, you're just seeing it from a different perspective. You're hearing things that you hadn't really heard. And then there's stuff when you're in it at the time. And, you know, one of the things I like to tell in these interviews about some of those tracks, I forgot how great the musicians were that I'd hired to play around me. And then you hear their performances and you realize, wow, like, oh, and then it takes me back and I go, yeah, I was really like treading water like crazy, trying to just stay afloat with these other people. Like, especially the drummer, Randy Cook, who I'll mention him because he plays on like Drive Time, Stand and Deliver. And like, he's on almost all those tracks. Randy, I just saw him the other day. He's touring with Britt Floyd, but he also played on the latest Billy Joel single. And like, Randy gets around, and he always did. And you know, it's full of life and energy. And his playing is just such a treat. You can sit down and listen to Diamonds and you can go, man, that drummer, like, he's something. Yeah. And, you know, I've been doing interviews all day this morning, and you know, other folks are going like, yeah, what about the bass playing on this track? And when I go, yeah, I know. Like, so many of the musicians that I'd hired ended up, they were lifers. They were going to keep playing on other people's records and touring with other people. And, you know, so they some of them became like kind of record producer, engineer kinds of guys. They had those kinds of ears. So when I listen to it now, I go, oh, yeah, geez, Rick, you threw yourself in the deep end, you know?
Yeah. Well, when you left Triumph, I mean, you know, what were you thinking at the time? I mean, how big of an adjustment was it for you creatively? You know, a big move, obviously, you know? I mean, what was that headspace like?
It felt like I didn't really have any choice at the time, you know. So from an organic, natural kind of, this is my, you know, my growth as an artist. In fact, I'd kind of been, you know, bouncing off of the, let's pick our, you know, metaphor, you know, the box that I was in, the envelope that I, you know, I wanted out so that I could be trying to do things on my own terms, not necessarily be subjected to a democratic kind of a partnership, which is not to say, you know, now I don't mean that in a negative way anymore. Certainly at the time there were certain things about it that, you know, I wasn't happy about, but, and it was a big, as you say, big thing to do just because it was going to cost me financially and mentally. It was going to become this tremendous struggle with lawyers fighting, you know, I was stepping into something, but I tried to compartmentalize that so that I could focus on, okay, I have a new life here. I have a new career. There's things that I really want to do. And that thing that I just described about hiring musicians that were going to really challenge me, that was something, you know. I think part of it too, like when you listen to songs like Big Lie and I don't know, is World of Wonder on Diamonds? I don't think it is. I don't think it made the cut. But, you know, Stand and Deliver, those kinds of tracks, they have lyric writing that, you know, I probably wouldn't have gotten away with in Triumph, you know. I was starting to say, okay, I'm putting on some big boy pants here, and I'm going to be more of a kind of a creative artist as opposed to you know, guitar hero, rock guy in a band, feeding a band image. It was more like, no, I get to be myself now. Now, you know, I say that. And of course, the first album I made, absolutely, it had an awful lot of stuff that was, you know, the record company kind of going, well, no, Rick, geez, we want you on the cover wearing a black leather jacket with a Les Paul, a black Les Paul. We okay, yeah, all right, fine, sure. Yeah, I get it. I'm willing to do it, but, you know, I mean, it's a funny thing, man. I, you know, my memoir came out last October, and this album, Diamonds, was supposed to come out right at the same time that the memoir did. So this whole walking down memory lane thing, right? You know, they didn't really get their shit together. It took them several months to catch up to the memoir. But the memoir, when it was coming out, I had all these, you know, ideas for titles. And then the public relations department of ECW Press, the publisher, goes, yeah, you know, Rick, have you read many rock star memoirs? I go, well, yeah, of course. I looked at a lot of them. And they go, you notice how many whatever your most successful single was, that's the title of your memoir. I go, oh yeah,
that's Bruce right. Springsteen. That's right.
You know? And they go, so Lay It on the Line. I think Lay It on the Line is a good title, Rick. I go, it is a good title. Okay. Yes. All right. So doesn't matter what stage your career is at, even when you become a senior citizen and you're, you know, you're still having the, you know, still having people go, what about the marketplace, buddy? What? And you go, yes, I get it. The marketplace. Yes.
Yeah. When you write, and that's, you touched on that too, that, you know, hiring your musicians and that, you know, that challenge, writing for, you know, a band and outfits, one thing, guys you work with all the time, you know their strengths, you know their capabilities, but then when you get to go and select this drummer, that bass player, this, you know, producer, how liberating is that? Also, how much of a gamble is that? Obviously, it worked out tremendously, of course, but when you're going through it, how much of a gamble and risk is that?
I mean, it's equal parts, all of those things. And sometimes the gamble pays off and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes the liberation is great. And sometimes, oh man, buddy, you were off on some tangent there. You were making a big mistake and you were so full of yourself. You know, sometimes you get your head so far up your own butt, you know, like you make mistakes and because you just don't have perspective. So you're hoping that people you work with are going to offer perspective that you're going to go, and they're going to offer it in a way where they're not necessarily, you know, I think a guy like Rick Rubin is a really good guy to look at for this because he doesn't really understand record engineering very well. He doesn't play an instrument. He wasn't really a musician before, but he's just a guy that kind of loves music. And then he's probably as much of a kind of a psychologist, psychiatrist, consultant, you know, as he is anything else. And he's really good at it. And so he's been on this incredibly wide variety of music, but has been a valuable producer in the sense that he helps artists really find the best of themselves, you know. And I think when you're on your own, in a way, you're kind of becoming your own producer. And there's a thing there where, and you know, I taught music business for a long time at Humber College, and I would tell students sometimes, look, you know, there's a big difference between an artist like Bruce Springsteen and David Bowie, but in some ways they're very similar kinds of artists because they really do have a strong sense of what it is they want to do. And, you know, you're not going to sit in a room with Madonna and be able to tell Madonna, you know, no, this is what you should do. And without her going, well, you don't tell me what to do. I'll decide. I'll take your input. And I'll, you know, take it into consideration, but I make the decisions about me, you know. And those kinds of artists, generally, they're the most interesting ones because they're going to be the ones that forge something where, and this is a weird thing, those kinds of artists that, you know, the Madonnas and the Springsteens and the Bowies, they're interesting because they have a consistency of integrity as an artist, and yet especially Bowie, Madonna, they change all the time. Springsteen doesn't change very much, but he grows, you know. People love him because he's gonna, you know, adhere to this the integrity that he's got. And so, and for me as an artist, I think when you listen to Diamonds, you're gonna hear this is a guy that's figuring out what his integrity is, and he's trying to, you know, that this was the beginning of it, these first three albums, you know. Later I just started becoming an indie artist and doing whatever the hell I like. I didn't care about the marketplace anymore, you know.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that too, because you know your style had evolved, and you know, musically, I mean, I think, you know, you started doing like you know, very different types of guitar playing, and how was that process for you? Was that just natural growth, trying different things?
Well, yes and no. I mean, part of it is because you're in the music business, and then at a certain point, the business is going like, "Well, sorry, buddy, you know, you're not going to get invited to the big table anymore, you know? Yeah. And so you're going, right. Like when you're 40 years old, 45 years old. And then for example, I had my career had been established as a rock kind of guy. And then rock radio was changing. MTV was changing, all of the things that, you know, I hadn't necessarily been a driving force, but I had been a nice passenger in that kind of world. You know, I'd done well, but then it's going like, yeah, sorry, man, we're pretty much going to Seattle grunge now. So, yeah. And you're getting too old for us. And you see that happening and you're going, oh, okay. And then it eventually got to the point where I wasn't going to get a mainstream record deal. That was for sure. You know?
Yeah.
So then you kind of go, well, then, do I really care? You know, that's the right. other side of it, right? I go, well, I think I've got enough of an audience. I've got enough of like loyal fans that love me that if I start doing an indie thing and I got a website and I do this and I manufacture my own records and I, you know, my kids would be around the dining room table licking envelopes for mail outs and stuff. Yeah. It's like, it becomes a kind of a kitchen table, cottage industry kind of thing. But I was doing all right. I was putting my kids through college and it was not a problem. It was a joy on the level of, hey, you know what? I think I'll do a jazz swing record. Hey, you know yeah. what? I think I'll do a blues record. You know what? I think I'll do a singer songwriter package next time. Like I had freedom to sort of do what I wanted without having anybody over my shoulder going, whoa, well, you know, yeah. wait a second, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Which is, you know, the ultimate, I think, for an artist too, that creativity, those limits that you don't have. I mean, anymore. When you guys were coming up, you know, I grew up in Detroit. So, you know, of course, you guys were across the river and then some. Were there any Detroit influences, you know, as you were coming up, as Triumph was coming together? I mean, can you talk a little bit about that?
About Detroit? I would love to. Yeah. I mean, first of all, Detroit is as important to music as Nashville is, as New York is, as LA. And the reason is because of not just Motown, but, you know, primarily and principally, certainly that. I mean, Motown was something that influenced the Beatles, you know, so yeah. that's how deep that Berry Gordy kind of thing went, you know. Have you seen that We Are the World thing that's on?
Yes. Oh, my God. Yeah. They did that in one night. It was crazy. Yeah,
I know. But the heart of it is Lionel Richie and Diana Ross and Michael Jackson. They're all Motown people that Berry Gordy kind of said, look, this is how you go about it. And so show business is in their DNA, you know. So that thing's driven by Lionel. Well, Quincy, obviously. But still, like, anyways, that's Motown. That's Detroit. Yeah. To me, that's a big part of it. But also, Detroit's the place where, like, I don't know, like the MC5 and you know, Ted Nugent was Detroit. Like when Triumph first started growing, we got a deal with a booking agency, BBR, BDR. I can't remember what they were, but it was Detroit based, and they represented like Nugent and then later Van Halen and like they were a big agency. And the guy that became our guy, Troy Blakely, I mean, he moved to L.A., but he was a Detroit boy, and he was with us his whole life. When Triumph did its reunion gig in Sweden, Troy was the agent that booked it. And Troy is he was a Detroit kind of guy. So there's roots there that are really deep. And, of course, Triumph would go out on tour. But obviously, playing Maple Leaf Gardens was a big one in Toronto. Yeah. But then when we got to go and play Joe Louis and sold it out for the first time, or, you know, that was an amazing thing to be on stage in these buildings where, you know, we never got to play the Olympia, but I can remember the first time we played Detroit, we played the Royal Oak Theater.
Yes. And, oh yeah.
And I felt like, hey, we just sold out a building in Detroit. We've made it. You know, like we're solid now. This is not some bullshit thing. Detroit likes us, you know. So, yeah, deep roots there. Deep.
That's so cool, man. That's awesome. You know, speaking of roots, we watched. I think we talked actually to Mike right before the or the big documentary came out. And that was so cool to see the fans, the diehard Triumph fans that had been there from day one, and to see you guys kind of coming together, especially during the end of it. What was your reaction to the documentary, and did that kind of spur any, you know, idea to maybe do some stuff down the road?
For sure on a lot of levels, but yeah, I think you're probably asking about Triumph, and
yeah,
there wasn't there, you know, I think there was, first of all, we had done the reunion of Sweden and Rocklahoma in 2007 or whatever, 2008. And but then, yes, the documentary was a thing where I think we were sitting down and I was talking with the Banger Films guys and saying, this is going to be a hard story to tell for you guys. Like, there's 40 odd years, and for 20 of them, we weren't talking to each other, you know, like, and you know, so many documentaries, they're reliant upon footage. Like, what have you got actual footage to be able to use from a documentary point of view? Then I said, no, you're gonna have to create something. And I said, I think you need a fan fest. What the heart of Triumph is really about its connection to fans. And so if we do that, I think that's gonna make it, and you get your cameras and you shoot that, like, you're gonna get lots and lots of great stuff you can use to tell the story of what the band really and truly is. So I don't want to necessarily take credit. I think sometimes a good idea, two or three people kind of have it percolating, and then when you're sitting around, it just becomes, you know, something that's on the table. I mean, the impact of it for the three of us was profound. But I think it also sort of pointed to the fact that kind of Gil went, yeah, okay, I've done this. I don't think I want to have to do this again. I don't think I want to have to gear my body up to sing and play. And for a drummer, I get that. You know, I mean, look at Phil Collins sitting in a chair and he can't play drums anymore. Yeah. You know, like, it's a tough gig. And to be the drummer in Triumph was an extremely tough gig, because I would write songs and say, okay, you know, I want you to be Keith Moon. For the last 4 minutes of the song, you know, I want fills, I want energy. And Gil was the singer of half the stuff. So it was really kind of on his plate. And he was kind of going, I think I've had enough, you know.
Yeah.
Now, to answer your question in a different way, though, when the documentary came out and we'd had that experience, I thought, this is a great story. It's the Triumph story. And those guys really, they own the brand name. It's their thing. And I went, I think I need to write a memoir so that I can tell my story and have my own thing that talks about, you know, who I was and what my life was like. And so I wrote the memoir, and that came out last October. Now, this Diamonds package that we're here talking about, it was supposed to come out at the same time the memoir
same
did,
time,
but it took them a few months to catch up. So anyhow.
Well, even though, you know, the timing was supposed to start to be the same between the book, the memoir, and the album. This will be a good way to kind of get people back into that too, I think, right? You know, I mean, they'll have the soundtrack, not to be, no pun intended, but it'll be the soundtrack to your life. You get the text there. And then, so it still will be a way to jog that memory for a lot of people, I think.
Absolutely. And I think, like, Diamonds to me is just, part one. Part two, like, because those three albums that I got the rights back from Duke Street, there's a whole other side of me, which is more the muso, singer, songwriter, esoteric side of the stuff that was on those albums. So the stuff that's on Diamonds, I think it's a really good compilation because it has a vibe that runs through it, because it is a little more harder rock, a little bit more guitar, electric guitar oriented. But there's the whole acoustic side of me and singer-songwriter side of me. I think that'll come out on another compilation, further on down the road. But, you know, I mean, I'm here in my dotage now, in my senior years, and I keep coming up with stuff. Like, as you can see, you know, I have a lot of influence. Yeah. So I've just done a thing called 10 Telecaster Tales, which is Telecaster guitar playing. I had this guitar.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah, this was So, and I wrote 10 pieces that I played fingerstyle kind of jazz.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, R&B, you know, a little bit of Detroit in all my roots. So this whole thing of roots, I'm revisiting it in different ways, and it all ties together, you know, the memoir, the 10 Telecaster tales, my next book of poetry, like all of these things. So
I just wanted to ask you one more question about, you know, gear. I mean, I see all the, you know, you've got the beautiful acoustics there. You've got the tele, I think some Les Pauls. I mean, what drives you to pick up one guitar versus another guitar? Is it a feel? I mean, every guitar can be a little different, I know. What do you look for when you're picking up a guitar?
Well, I mean, I've had so many in my life. There's about 50 in this room. And I've had hundreds and hundreds of guitars in my life. That's not an exaggeration, because I had endorsement deals and stuff. Sometimes when I pick up a guitar, I'm looking for what ergonomics, what will my hands, how are they feeling? You know, yesterday I was playing on flat wound arch top, you know, and then I went, no, I'm going back to the Tele. And I've been going through this big Tele kick lately. I have a Tele here. There was a Canadian guitar player named Ed Bickert, and I had this guitar, and it says Bickert right on it.
Yeah.
And I had this made because I love this. This has flat wound strings on it. So this is kind of like a jazz guitar, even though it's a Tele. And sometimes those are the things that'll pull me. I'll go, oh, I haven't played that in a while. I want to go to that. The other thing I should mention is I've been getting a little bit of arthritis going. So playing on acoustics, sometimes it's a grind after a bit, whereas electric guitars, they're a little more cooperative.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
I can get along with them for longer periods of time. But that's not to say, I had somebody on my fan forum the other day say, you know, Rick, I love the sound of 12 string acoustics, you know, how about you do something on 12 string acoustic? And I went, my hands, my electrics, blah, blah, blah. But then in the back of my mind, I'm going, yeah, it's been a while. And a 12 string, it can do things that other guitars can't, you know. I mean, that's why I have these, because you know, a resonator guitar will do something that no other guitar will do. You know, I have a Coral Electric sitar guitar, and sitar guitars, they're so cool. I mean, speaking of Motown, you know, there were those tracks where that guitar, it was a sound that, like, and then everybody was using it, right? BJ Thomas was using one, and you know, the box, you remember the letter? It had a sitar guitar. Yeah!